Chapter 31. I woke late the next morning, considerably subdued in health and energy, a regrettable after-effect of aguardiente when consumed in large quantities. None of my companions was in evidence, not even Vespertine. I assumed they had all risen earlier and were enjoying a hearty breakfast without me. Stiff and moaning gently from my various aches, I washed and descended to the main floor of the Belvedere, where Stoker was staring balefully at a plate of cold eggs and taking tentative sips from a scalding cup of tea. Wisps of steam wreathed his head, giving him the look of one of the lesser satyrs. "Where is Harry?" I asked.
"Gone,"
he told me, clipping off the word sharply. "Gone where? Did you let him take a turn in the Roman baths?" I asked with a forced smile. Stoker has a notoriously proprietary attitude towards the baths. Lord Rosmorin built them to soothe his occasional bouts of rheumatics, but Stoker is the one likeliest to be found in them at any hour of the day or night. Since Stoker and I had discussed the fact of my marriage, something unfinished had lingered between us, something I was not entirely ready to conclude. I had no notion of his feelings on the matter. The fact that I was afraid to discover them did not reflect particularly well upon my character or my courage. So I concealed my uneasiness behind a quip, and was not surprised that he did the same. When he spoke, his tone was pleasant, studiedly so.
"I have not seen Harry this morning," he told me.
Stoker handed over the scarlet leather box, stamped with the papal tiara, but I already knew what I would find when I opened it. "Oh, no," I moaned. I flicked open the clasp and lifted the lid. The collection of papal cameos was gone, and in its place a single scribbled word in a hand I knew only too well. "Sorry." I flopped into my chair with another moan, folding my arms upon the desk and dropping my head onto them. He was so nearly good. When I raised my head, Stoker was watching me closely. I sighed. "I shall have to make good with his lordship." He sighed heavily.
"Would you like me to—"
"No," I said quickly. "Harry is my responsibility."
"Yes,"
he said, his expression inscrutable.
"He is, after all, your husband."
There was an unmistakable note of bitterness in his voice, something dark and angry. He had behaved with considerable bonhomie towards Harry, but I understood he had done so whilst it was expedient, when we were in the midst of abduction and the potential threat of violence, and he had been courteous enough upon our return to the Belvedere. But it was only at that moment that I understood precisely what that civility had cost him. He turned on his heel and left me then, and I added Stoker to the list of problems yet unsolved. During a painful interview with Lord Rosmorin, I accepted responsibility for the missing cameos. I simply said they ought to have been locked up, and my neglect had resulted in them being lost. He waved away the subject, uncomfortable as he always was when discussing matters of finance, but I insisted, and we at length came to an understanding that I would recompense him for them at their current market value by having a certain sum deducted from my pay packet each quarter. The result was that I would be beholden to Lord Rosmorin for the next 40 or so years, I reflected darkly. I had no plans to leave his lordship's employ in the near future, but the very fact that such an option would be impossible was yet another crime to lay at Harry's door. I cursed him soundly as I left Bishop's Folly and made my way to the Hippolyta Club, known affectionately to its members as the Curiosity Club. The steps had been freshly washed, and the brass plaque proclaiming the club's motto, Alis Ulat Proprius, was gleaming with fresh polish. A pair of tall, arrow-shaped topiary flanked the doors like living sentinels, and I sniffed appreciatively as I entered the club. Inside, the odours of beeswax and rose and wood smoke mingled with the enticing aromas of the luncheon being served in the dining room. But I was bent upon other business. I signed in and briskly took myself up to one of the smaller private meeting rooms on the first floor. I had reserved it for my own use for only half an hour, and I hoped my guest would be punctual. In fact, she anticipated me, for she had already been shown to the room before I arrived and was sitting in one of the chairs before the fire, clutching a reticule in her gloved hands and playing with the clasp. The Italian greyhound, Al Ijlia, shivered at her feet, dressed in a little coat made from an old jumper. She looked distinctly miserable, but not more than her mistress, who regarded me with dull eyes as I entered. She rose politely, but seemed on the verge of collapse. I rang at once for refreshment, guessing she suffered from inanition. We spoke of meaningless things until the food arrived, and I insisted she drink two strong cups of heavily sugared tea and consume a plate of sandwiches and another of cake before changing the subject. "I am certain you wish to know why I asked you here," I began. "Asked?" Her expression was faintly mocking. "You insisted, to the point that you included a train ticket. It led to the most furious row with Charles. You do understand that I have run away, Miss Speedwell. It was the only way to escape my family in order to do as you asked. I have come as instructed, and I am penniless and alone in the world now. So I hope you will provide me with enlightenment and possibly employment before I starve on the streets," she said. And I heard a note of hysteria creeping into her voice. She was so very young, I reminded myself, almost the same age as when I had married Harry Spenlove, scarcely more than a child, but determined to survive, nay, to thrive. "You will understand shortly," I promised her. Without further delay, I launched into an explanation in the simplest and most straightforward of terms. But the swift reversal in her fortunes confused her, and she could not accept the facts until I explained them, and even then she queried me at length.
"I am to study with the Mrs. Marvell in Scotland," she said in a small voice.
"Yes, in exchange for doing light domestic and secretarial labour in their observatory, writing up notes, dusting instruments, you will be given lodging and board and tutelage."
"And a stipend," she breathed.
"A very tiny one," I said. It would be even tinier than I had intended now that my own salary had been reduced. But her expenses would be few, and I had every expectation that Effie would prove up to the challenge. "You will live a hand-to-mouth existence, but you will not starve, and you will be doing what you love. Moreover, you will be given opportunities, if you prove a dutiful and diligent student, to do your own research and to write. The Mrs. Marvell maintain a voluminous correspondence with fellow astronomers throughout the world, and are happy to provide the necessary introductions when you have proven worthy of them. All you need do is work hard and think about the stars, Effie." She had held herself taut throughout the conversation, but it was at this point her resolve seemed to falter. Her hands shook, and she forced out the next words through a throat that must have been tight with emotion.
"But Al Ijlia, I cannot leave her," she lamented, "and she would never abide the cold in Scotland."
She held tightly to the little animal, her feelings clearly at war. Her own desires were in conflict with her responsibility to her pet, and the fact that she hesitated to leave the dog behind, even at the expense of her work, made me like her even better. I sighed, knowing I would regret the next words I spoke. "I will take her," I told her. "There are already 4 dogs. Why not a 5th? Besides, Stoker is handy with a needle. I suspect he will enjoy making little coats for her." Effie wept then, liberally dropping her tears into Al Ichlia's fur as the dog stared at me with what looked like an entirely human expression of resentment. "I do not know how to thank you," Effie said, mastering her emotion at last. I handed her a small portfolio. "You haven't time, my dear. Your train leaves in an hour. There is your ticket and some money for food. I have included the latest journal of the Society for Astronomical Studies. I thought you might enjoy some reading for the train." She fell into weeping again, and it proved much more difficult to dislodge her the second time. But at last, I managed to persuade her, still sniffling and petting the dog, out of the room, down the stairs and into a cab, whilst I held an indifferent Al Ichlia in my arms. "Wait," I called, and Effie put down the window. "I am certain that Anjali has told you by now that the man calling himself Jonathan Hathaway was not your brother." She nodded, sniffling hard. "I knew from the beginning." "How? When everyone else in the family was uncertain?" Effie's smile was cool.
"Because one of the tasks Mary liked to set for me was collecting the boots to be polished. I took his and compared them to the brogues that I wore. The brogues were Jonathan's, you know. The newcomer's boots were fully an inch shorter."
"And a man's feet may grow, but they will not shrink," I said, shaking my head. "So stupidly obvious, and yet everyone overlooked it but you." She put her hand out the window to shake mine.
"What is overlooked is often the most significant, Miss Speedwell."
She said a final farewell to Al Ichlia.
"You will write and tell me how she fares?"
she asked, an anxious line etched between her brows. But her eyes were bright with anticipation, and I knew in her heart she had already begun her grand adventure. "I promise," I vowed. Effie waved again, and was still waving long after the driver sprang the horses and moved smartly into traffic. I looked down at the dog, and she gave me a long, baleful look. "We are going to be friends," I warned her, "whether you like it or not." Chapter 32. The matter of Effie Hathaway had been settled to my satisfaction, the matter of the cameos slightly less so. But it was the best I could do under the circumstances. I returned to the Belvedere and threw myself into my work, hoping that the methodical cataloguing and restoring of Lepidoptera would, as it had so often done in the past, soothe my troubled spirits. Yet too often in the following days, I would find my attention wandering and my thoughts elsewhere. Stoker and I spoke little during the days that followed our adventure with the impossible impostor, as I had come to think of Harry Spenlove. I had, true to my word, entertained JJ to tea after my sending Effie on her way. Without alluding to the Hathaways or my own personal entanglement with Harry, I told her everything I knew about Isabel de Armas MacGregor, relating the details of the Brazilian railway affair. JJ took copious notes and then went to ground. When she surfaced, 2 days later, it was with an exposé published on the front page of the Daily Harbinger. "Lady Adventuress Swindles Brazilian Royalty," screamed the headline, and there were several illustrations of her, enabled by my description. Yoran, I was interested to see, warranted little more than a footnote. It was the notion of a lady criminal that intrigued the public.
You realise you will have only enraged her further,
Stoker pointed out. I shrugged. She hates me in any event, and she cannot be certain that I was the one who told JJ about her endeavours.
It would take precious little to find out,
he said. If she is as clever as Harry says, she will have brushed the dust of London off of her shoes and taken herself far away. In making her crimes public, I have made England a dangerous place for her.
And won yourself an implacable enemy,
he said, his eyes never leaving my face. I am not afraid of her, I told him, squaring my shoulders. If she wants a fight, she is welcome to bring one. We have unfinished business in any event, I added, touching the length of velvet ribbon at my throat. The cut had healed cleanly, leaving a slender pink line. I had taken to tying a ribbon to conceal it, but I was reminded of her every time I had occasion to use the looking glass. I would have continued the conversation, but Stoker had already turned away, as he had so often done in the preceding days. We had spoken little, and never anything of real importance. We discussed the collections and evaluated one another's articles for publication. We exercised the dogs, and Stoker, as I anticipated, spent a good deal of his free time sewing small coats for the eternally shivering Al Ijlia. But further than that, we did not tread. We walked carefully around one another, as if picking our way across the dangers of Dartmoor, fearing to step into a bog and drown if we moved too quickly or in the wrong direction. And finally, one brilliant morning, I could bear it no longer. I had been working in the vivarium, attending to a particularly beautiful and demanding brood of Agrius Claudina. The adults feed on rotting fish, and the smell, as has been pointed out to me on several occasions and by numerous people, is less than wholesome. Suddenly, as I watched the brilliant scarlet slash of wings, I was filled with a melancholy I could not bear. Division from Stoker, in any form, was like an amputation of the soul, and I would do anything to bridge the abyss between us. I made my way to the Belvedere, where I found Stoker precisely where I anticipated, with his thylacine. He had made great progress with the beast, conjuring a lifelike appearance so convincing I could fairly hear the snarl from its open jaws. But Stoker, like all genius, is never content with the obvious. Besides the creature's ferocity, he had paid homage to its intelligence. Fashioning eyes of such cunning, coupled with understanding, I should not have been surprised if the beast spoke to me. It is extraordinary, I told him truthfully. Stoker turned in obvious surprise. So intent had he been upon his work, he had not heard me enter. As he often did when in the throes of his efforts, he was stripped to the waist, covered in sweat and sawdust and streaks of glue. His hair, always overlong, was a tumble of black waves, his jaw heavily shadowed by unshaven beard. He was filthy and looked every inch the disreputable pirate, and he was the loveliest thing I had ever seen. He looked at his trophy.
Yes, he has come along well, hasn't he?
Stoker said, but it was no question. He knew the value of his work. There was no one in England, indeed in all of Europe, to touch him for skill and for artistry. You should be very proud, I ventured. His lordship will want him in pride of place when the museum opens.
In another 40 or so years,
Stoker agreed with a small smile. "Stoker, you must know how sorry I am," I began. His jaw tightened.
"The fault is as much mine. I understand why you did not tell me about Harry. I understand why you married him. And I understand why you wanted to leave. I even understand why you did not wish to speak of him after you believed him dead. There is no power or pain as devastating as a first love."
He stepped towards me and raised his hand as if to touch me, but dropped it back to his side.
"I understand all of that, and I can even forgive it. I have done as much. As we have always known, Veronica, we are the same, you and I."
"Quicksilver," we said, "and the rest of the world is mud," I reminded him.
"Just so. And yet, for all that I understand and all that I forgive, I cannot forget. I cannot forget that when you might have relied upon me, you felt that you could not. And I have to wonder, where does that leave us?"
I stepped towards him and reached for his hands, filthy and scarred, strong and sensitive. I pressed a kiss to the back of one. "For too long, I have resisted allowing anyone else to be responsible for me. I have loved you, but held you at bay, determined to withhold part of myself. I am willing now to put my happiness into these hands." My head was still bent when I felt the pressure of his lips upon my hair. Gently, slowly, he withdrew his hands and stepped back. "Ho," I said quietly.
"Veronica, you are his legal wife,"
he replied, his eyes bleak with heartbreak. "If you think for a moment that I care for him..."
"Of course not. I admit that I have wrestled with jealousy as any mortal man might, but I am content that whatever feelings you once had for him are long dead."
"Then why?" I asked.
"Your feelings must have changed, but I am not certain that his have,"
he told me.
"What does that matter to me?" I demanded. "To us?"
"If he did not care for you, he would have secured a legal separation, a divorce, even."
"If he did care for me, he would not have abandoned me to die in a volcanic eruption,"
I reminded him icily.
"You are his legal wife,"
he repeated.
"And I know what it means to have someone break that bond. I want to believe that you are entirely mine. But in the eyes of the world, you belong to him."
"I belong to no one," I reminded him, "except myself. And I wish to be with you. Harry Spenlove made himself irrelevant to me when he left me 6 years ago. Do not let him come between us now."
For an instant, I thought I had swayed him, but he said nothing for a long moment. And when he spoke, it was in a voice thick with emotion.
"I need time, Veronica."
I forced a smile. "We have all the time in the world," I assured him. "I will be here." The next day, I arrived at the Belvedere to find Stoker absent. The thylacine had been finished, eyeballs brightly polished, the coat brushed and gleaming. Two envelopes and a parcel lay upon my desk. The first envelope was stamped, the address written in a hasty scrawl. I withdrew several pieces of paper. On top was a legal document, followed by a brief note.
"My dearest Veronica,
Please accept this as a token of my gratitude. I do not expect that you will think of me, but I hope that this ensures that if the name of Harry Spenlove ever crosses your mind, a smile will follow. H.
I turned to the legal document. It was the marriage lines Stoker had spoken of, a record of my wedding to Harry Spenlove, and my eyes fell upon the space where the attending clergyman ought to have signed. It was blank. So, too, were the spaces for witnesses. Without those, there was no marriage, I realised, with a dizzying rush of emotion. I had married him in good faith, but Harry, ever the opportunist, had, through some sleight of hand, ensured the proper legalities were not fulfilled. I had, it seemed, lived in sin with him in Sumatra. Delicious, liberating, unfettered, and unbinding sin. Whatever his intentions in keeping the document, in giving it to me, he had ensured that I knew I was free. It was thoroughly typical of him to keep the information from me and then present it as though bestowing a royal favour. I was conscious of relief, deep and profound, with an equal certainty that if I ever saw Harry Spenlove again, a smile was not what he could expect. My gaze fell then to the postscript.
I must thank you for the loan of the cameos. I needed travelling money in order to retrieve my nest egg, but have now done so, and am happy to enclose the pawn ticket and sufficient funds for their retrieval.
Wrapped neatly in a sheet of paper was the ticket from the pawnbroker and a thick stack of £50 notes. As soon as I restored the cameos, I could consider my obligation to Lord Rosmoren at an end, I realised with another rush of happiness, followed almost instantly by irritation that Harry had not simply asked for the loan of some travelling money. If he could only be bothered to deal forthrightly, I reflected, he would be a good deal less irritating. The last items in the envelope from Harry were a handful of banknotes in exactly the amount that I had made him a loan of for a suit of new clothes and a shave. A small slip of paper read, "Debt discharged." The parcel was wrapped in brown paper and bore the label of Witcherly and Sons in Bloomsbury, the purveyors of the highest quality impedimenta for natural historians. I opened it to find a butterfly net. Fashioned of ash, it was elegant and lightweight, each ring painted with a narrow, smart stripe of hyacinth pink. The handle fit my grip perfectly, and the net was dark green silk, supple as a flower petal. I gave it an experimental swish, and it cut through the air with a whisper. At the end of the handle, my initials had been embossed in gold. It was not a mere love token, I realised, but a gift from someone who truly understood what mattered to me. Any man might present orchids or jewels, but Stoker had given me back my joy. In the wrappings was an envelope marked only with the letter V in a bold, familiar hand, the paper smelling of honey drops and smeared in one corner with dried glue, and I smiled as I anticipated some line of Keats. Instead, it began without preamble. And it was no poetry.
I have accepted an invitation to survey a collection of mounted wolves in Bavaria on Lord Rosmoren's behalf. I expect to be gone for some weeks. I have had word from Charles Hathaway that the butterflies he promised are en route, and I am certain you will enjoy the study of them.
I stared at the page. Then turned it over, certain I would find more writ upon the back. There was nothing. My hands trembling only slightly, I laid the net carefully aside and picked up the third envelope. The letter inside was headed with the Templeton Vane crest. It was from Tiberius,
Viscount Templeton Vane and Stoker's eldest brother. He, too, began without preamble. A family trait, I thought, in some irritation.
I am in Rome, and have discovered the most exciting collection of bird wings, southern-tailed Ornithoptera meridionalis, which my hostess is willing to donate to Lord Rosemoran's burgeoning museum, provided they are treated with the utmost care by an accomplished lepidopterist. You have only to come and claim them.
I picked up Stoker's note and sat for a moment, holding the letters. Stoker's in my right, Tiberius's in my left. Then I pulled out the atlas, turning the pages from Bavaria to Rome and back again. After a long while, I rose, whistling for George, the hall boy. He trotted in, his expression expectant.
Yes, miss?
You will need to watch the dogs, George, I told him, as I unearthed my carpet bag and began to pack. I am going on a journey. Excelsior! This is Angèle Meisters. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of An Impossible Imposter by Deanna Raban. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Amber Beard, edited by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2022 by Raban Creative, LLC. Production copyright 2022, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.